ebook publisher and marketing service company, Just Imagine It Inc., presents. Get behind me. Now, stay there. Your favorite fun-filled, informative art and entertainment podcast. Available on iTunes, PRX, Podbean, and right here locally in the great Pacific Northwest on KSKQ 89.5 FM Ashland, Oregon. Art and entertainment news and views that you want to know. Today's podcast is brought to you by the fine folks at Downpour.com, the one stop for all your audio and digital book needs. Join the Downpour Audio Club and save up to 50% on digital downloads, exclusive member-only deals, and promotions with no commitment, and you can cancel at any time. Only $9.99 per month. And be sure to check out our wonderful book rental program, Fantastic Books for People on the Go. That's downpour.com.
On this episode, we speak with movie director Don Thacker about his award-winning film, Motivational Growth. There's love and terror in the Middle East as we continue our conversations with Dr. Frank Romano and soon-to-be blockbuster movie, The Finest Hours, in our downpour.com special feature right after the news you want to know.
Charlie Stanton.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
I'm Holly Lorian Adams.
I'm Kayla Elrod.
Hi, I'm Sean Mark Nipper.
And I'm Maya Seligman. Here's a look at our top stories in the art and entertainment world. There was a video posted to Facebook of a homeless man playing on the piano, and he was playing the Styx song, Come Sail Away. Mm-hmm. It was posted on Facebook, and it now has been watched nearly 6 million times. Let me tell you the story. It's okay. Really interesting.
I saw it.
Yeah. Did you see it?
Oh, me too.
Yeah. He's an amazing musician.
So good.
Well, in Sarasota, Florida, a civic arts project, they put all these public pianos out in the city, and they didn't expect that something like this would happen. But known around town as Boone, there's a 51-year-old homeless man, and he's been playing music on one of the pianos, and it has attracted a lot of attention because he is so talented. I saw a video of it. He's, you know, the video that was posted. He's a scruffy man. He has a beard, Red Sox hat that he puts out on the piano for tips. And he has been a viral sensation because it turns out he studied music earlier in his life and he learned to play a number of instruments. And he was forced to drop out of music school because he ran out of money. And then he took various jobs, his wife passed away, and he developed a drug problem and lost his son to social services. And so his life kind of fell apart. He became homeless. And now he is being able to tap into this amazing musical skill and share it with other people. And people are really noticing that he is someone to give credit to, you know, help him. And so someone, after seeing the video, someone in the community, actually, they reached out to a local restaurant, and the restaurant said that they might be willing to have him play in the piano bar area. I haven't gotten to
see that. It's just a cool story, and, you know, I saw the video too. You know, as a matter of fact, you know, just to give our listening audience out there, you know, an idea of how well this guy's played, let's hear a little bit of Come Sail Away, and, you know, by him.
Yeah.
You know, I used to live in Sarasota, Florida.
No, you did?
Yeah, and it is one of the coolest places.
It's great. I spent some time down there.
You know, and they've got, like, you know, this really, really nice beach there called Siesta Key. And it's always voted one of the top 10 beaches in the world. It's almost like Venice, California, because you can go anywhere on a boat, too. But there's such a, you know, like an artsy town, you know, but in a different way than when we are. You know, we're like a very artistic community.
Here in Ashland.
It's kind of like Friday night art walk every day.
Yeah, every day. And it's kind of like going to the circus. And here's the reason why, ladies and gentlemen. Because Sarasota, Florida was built by Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus. They built it for all their performers to retire to.
Whoa.
And it is so cool, man.
So Donald Gold, this homeless guy, fits right in because
he's part of the circus.
Yeah, he's the performer.
Yeah, and I mean, and it actually, that's what it was built for. And that's why all the streets are like Ringling Boulevard, you know, Barnum & Street and stuff like that. I mean, and, you know, like when we lived there, it was so cool. You know, and they got like the, you know, their movie houses only show independent film, festivals, but independent films, all foreign films. And, you know, every place, you know, is, there's so many boats, man. And, the sands are, it's all the white sand. So it no matter how hot it gets, and believe me, it gets hot there.
Yeah.
You can walk barefoot on the sand, it doesn't burn your feet because white sand has an alkali in it, you know. And everybody there, you know, either takes their boat or they walk or whatever, and it's just like, you know, it's a really cool place. So when I saw this, I mean, that first thing that struck me is even though we're a very artistic community, Ashland, right? They're in Sarasota, man. I mean, they're putting out pianos on the streets for people to say, like, hey, if you want to come by and play the piano, go ahead. you know, that sad trusting of a community.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so picturesque. So, you know, it was a great story, man. Great story. Mm-hmm. And we're going to go from something that was, you know, just a really fantastic to something that turned out to be not so fantastic.
Oh, man.
Oh. Yeah. Sorry, Jerry.
Yeah, you can hear my heart breaking over here.
So there was recently a movie that came out. And, you know, superhero movies have been doing phenomenal, especially the Marvels. And, you know, even the new Spider-Man reboots, they did pretty well.
And the X-Men movies, they really resurrected that franchise.
Yeah, so...
Even Ant-Man.
Ant-Man,
that's a Marvel Studios production.
Yeah.
Of course it's gonna be good. Right, it was...
Yeah, they tied that one all together, too. But they recently tried to reboot. I think that's Hollywood. They should rename. They should get rid of that sign up in L.A. and it says Hollywood, and they should make it Reboot.
Reboot.
Welcome to Reboot. We're just going to... because that seems like what they're doing, but they tried. I say tried. They did. They made a movie called Fantastic Four, and they started over, and it bombed. Yeah. It did not do well.
I mean, it made $26 million its first
weekend
on a $150 million budget.
Right.
So
yeah.
That technically would be a
so problem. By movie, you know, superhero movie standards, it did not do well. It doesn't help when the director of the movie, the weekend that it's premiering, tweets out, you know, this would have been a way better movie if I would have had more control.
Actually, the tweet said, I made a great version of this movie that would have been well received. Too bad you'll never see it.
And then he
immediately deleted it.
Right. He took it right off.
But and enough then, people but that, saw it that it made a difference.
Dude, the internet does not forget.
No. And so, yeah, it's super sad. Because I know that, you know, he worked really hard. But I think that there was some issues on set from what they're talking about, right?
Yeah. Here's the deal. So Josh Trank is the director of Fantastic Four. He's the guy who directed Chronicle a couple years ago. It was a movie about, like, a couple of teenagers that gained telekinetic superpowers.
It was like a found film style.
Yeah, it was like found footage kind of thing. Huge success. I think it made $120 million off of, like, an $8 million budget. So they bring him in and they say, okay, great. Take this superhero franchise. Part of the reason Chronicle did well is because nobody owned the rights to those characters. They weren't property of anybody. So you have a studio, you know, here that has the rights to this property, has to make something to retain the rights, doesn't know how to take their hand off the tiller. So, of course, they're going to interfere in many ways. This is only his second big movie, and I've heard a lot of reports, you know, that, like, he was very difficult to work with on the set, holding himself up, putting fabric around his monitor so nobody could see it. It was just plagued with problems top to bottom.
Well,
Thank you for sharing that.
I find it interesting they're giving the director a bunch of grief, but it sounds like there was also some issues with Miles Teller on set as well. And as a matter of fact, sources are coming out now that they actually were in each other's face and, you know, telling each other, you throw the first blow. No, you hit me. And so there's an interview with Miles coming out that he is kind of an a-hole from what they're saying. That he was trashing his movie Divergent, where he's like, yeah, I didn't really get a good part, but I took the money and, you know, it was, yeah, whatever. And so you kind of see his character coming out a little bit more. So I don't think it helps when you're getting shut down from the studio saying, you know, we're going to cut these three action scenes. And I mean, you know that they cut action scenes in this movie because there is not any action. There's zero.
Well, you know what? You know, from what I can gather from the story and stuff like that, you know, they just... And it happens in every franchise, you know, when you're making movies. You can't hit a home run every time you go up to the plate. And that's, you know, just one of those things. But one of the people, you know, that seems to be able to hit a home run every time he comes up to the plate, whether he's doing a film or he's doing something, you know, positive for the planet, is Leonardo DiCaprio. Wouldn't you agree, Holly?
Absolutely. Here's one I wouldn't mind calling me up on Facebook.
Well, you're already friends with Jane Franco.
That's right. What more do I want? Yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio. The actor Leonardo DiCaprio has pledged $15 million in donations to host of environmental causes. The actor's foundation announced on Tuesday that it was awarding grants to groups including Amazon Watch, Save the Elephants, the Tree People, and the World Wildlife Fund. DiCaprio says the destruction of our planet continues at a pace we can no longer afford to ignore. We have a responsibility to innovate a future where the habitability of our planet does not come at the expense of those who inhabit it. This 40-year-old actor has been an active environmentalist throughout his career. He created the Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation in 1998, the year after the Titanic came out, to fund efforts to protect the planet and its endangered species. It now supports such projects in more than 40 countries, including measures to prevent illegal fishing off the coast of Costa Rica. Last year, the United Nations named DiCaprio the UN Messenger of Peace, with a special focus on climate change. When he was speaking at the UN in September about climate change, he said, "This disaster has grown beyond the choices that individuals make. This is now about our industries and governments."
Yeah, you know what? And that's really something that, you know, another example where somebody, you know, puts their money where their mouth is, you know, because he is not just another pretty face, you know. I happen to think he's a very good actor. But, you know, when you mentioned that he had done this right after Titanic, and he was very young then. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like 20 years ago. So he was like 20 years old. And he's like, you know, hey, I'm going to take my money and put it, you know, to good use. And I've seen him do, you know, a few projects that where he's lent his name to independent films and produced them and backed them on environmental issues and things like that. So hats off to Leo. And plus, he goes out with every supermodel there is. You know, so,
you know, at the same time.
I think, you know, it doesn't really cost him, you know, a lot of money to be entertained. He's
like... So you're saying if I was going to maybe do a movie about...
What's that, Leo?
Oh, thank you. You know, I do get that a lot. And I get Tom Cruise every now and then, too. Yeah. Actually, no.
I didn't even know, but it's cool, man. You know, I mean, you know, be who you want to be.
Well, thank you. But
I have never been out with either one of them, so, you know... You know, hats off to you.
They're both great. Trust me.
Oh, Maya. Nice, Maya.
Oh, don't you know the kiss and tell rule?
He's just an icon. You know, like there are just certain people.
Like there's only one
icons.
Elvis.
Like what?
Like there's only one Elvis.
Like only one Elvis. Only one Michael Jackson. Only one Keith Richards.
That's right.
And Keith Richards, you know.
I can't believe he's still alive.
You know what amazes me? Yeah, that's what I was just about to say. Of those four people I just listed, if I told you 30 years ago Keith Richards was the one who's still going to be alive, seriously, you'd have called me a liar and spit in my face. But it's true. Elvis is gone. Michael is gone. Keith Richards still rolling along. I'm convinced he will never die. So Keith Richards, we discussed it a couple of months ago. I think there is a documentary coming. It's called Keith Richards Under the Influence, and it is going to be on
everything.
Netflix. And Netflix is going to be rolling it out to their 65 million plus global subscribers on September 18th.
I can't wait, man.
Around the corner. I am pumped. It goes into a lot. It's an unprecedented look into the sounds and influences of Keith Richards' life. Everything that inspired him, from electric blues, country honky tonk. It cracks me up whenever I think of Keith Richards playing honky tonk. But it's true. I mean, he's a real musician's musician. It follows him as he creates his first solo album in 23 years. I like this quote. "If there's a Mount Rushmore of rock and roll, Keith's face is surely on it." I would not disagree with that statement at all. The movie is supposed to be full of humor, knowledge, and wisdom. In fact, Morgan Neville, the documentary's director, said, he goes, "To my relief, Keith Richards turned out to be a real man, full of humor, knowledge, and wisdom. That's the real Keith we've worked to capture in our film, and I'm honored to bring it to a global audience via Netflix." I'm really looking forward to this. I love the behind the scenes of an icon like this. I'm sure it's going to be fantastic. Has anyone else seen anything about it?
Yeah, I have. You know, and one of the things, you know, that, you know, I really like about Netflix is that they're coming out with all this original content and things like that. You know, and like their global reach here, you know, is like, you know, to over 50 countries. And, you know, one of the things they were talking about in addition to the Keith Richards movie that they're doing, you know, is like, you know, you've got the Netflix original movie I can't pronounce her name, it's Cambodian, but the movie's called First They Killed My Father, A Daughter of Cambodia Remembers.
Mm.
And from filmmaker Angelina Jolie.
Yes.
And she is, you know, I mean, we've talked about it before. I don't know if Maya remembers this or not. Mm. She is a fantastic director.
Mm.
And she, you know, she writes her own films. It just didn't, like, you know, like...
In the Land of Milk and Honey, about the Bosnia.
Yeah, yes. And it's like, you know what? I saw that movie, you know, a couple times. I watched it, and it was so good, and... I was like, you know, I think she's a better director and writer than she is an actress.
Yeah.
Multi-talented.
And she's a very good actress.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and they signed, Netflix signed Adam Sandler to some movies he's going to make just for Netflix. They really are blowing up. Netflix, you are doing it right.
Yeah. So yeah. For Netflix films, is there ever a forte that shows them to like an audience? What if you want to go and see it on a big movie theater size screen?
I think that's something that they're working on because, you know, as a Netflix stock owner, you know, you get the insight on what they're doing. And they're working on a deal right now where they're gonna either merge or take over Time Warner. And so it's gonna be either Time Warner or they're going to make a deal with Amazon, one of the two, where they get into the movie theaters.
I was going to say, because most theaters now, 95% probably, top of my head, don't quote me on that, but most theaters are digital now and have the capability of digitally streaming. Mm-hmm. So it'd be perfectly fine. It's not like they would have to take it, convert it to 8mm or 35mm or whatever. They literally can just click it on and show it on the big screen.
Yeah, it seems like a good opportunity right there, considering the stuff that's coming out.
Might draw people back to the Netflix theaters.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and people still go to the theaters all the time, you know, and that's just one of the things, and we discussed it before, you know, it's just like, you know, people like going to the movie theater, man. I don't, you know, it's just like people like reading books, like, you know, even though, you know, we all have tablets, people still like, you know, reading a paperback or whatever. And people like good movies. And if there's a good movie, like the movie Maya's going to tell us about, they're going to the movie theater to see it. And Kayla made the comment earlier about, you know, Tom Cruise's new movie. It's like, that's the kind of movie that, you know, yes, you can watch it on your tablet, or yeah, you can watch it on your TV, but, you know, you'd rather get the movie experience.
Get the movie experience.
Boom, right
so
in your face.
Worth you know, going surround to the sound.
Especially you know? When there's an interesting person in history that is just so weird. You're thinking, how could this really happen? If you see it in a movie, it would make it much more tangible for you to believe it.
Really?
So has anyone read the book The Devil in the White City, Murder, Magic, and Madness at the Fair That Changed America?
I did, but under the covers, I must say.
I haven't read it, but I heard. It was a huge...
Yeah. Well, it's a very interesting book, and there is a role in it that Leonardo DiCaprio has been wanting to play for a long time, and finally Paramount closed a splashy deal to acquire Eric Larson's book that I just mentioned. And so he is going to get to play one of the most prolific serial killers in Chicago history, the 19th century equivalent of Hannibal Lecter, Dr. H.H. Holmes.
Oh, the murder house guy.
Yeah.
Dude, I'm telling you.
Yeah, he's freaky. He's freaky. He murdered somewhere between like 27 to 200 people at the time when Chicago was hosting the World's Fair of 1893. And he constructed the World's Fair Hotel than you can imagine, because he basically used his charm to lure guests into what was known at later as the Murder Castle. Yeah. It was like basically had a gas chamber, a crematorium, a dissecting table, and he would do all sorts of stuff and basically kill the people, and then he would sell their cadavers and make money. He was a really weird guy. So Leonardo DiCaprio is going to be playing him. Ooh, and he's going to be teaming up with Martin Scorsese.
Of course.
You remember them from The Wolf of Wall Street.
This is going to be violent.
Exactly. They both got Oscar nominations for it.
That's right.
And Gangs of New York. Yeah. And The Departed.
Nice. Okay, so I was so curious about this since I haven't read the book that I ended up doing some research. I found some really weird stuff about Dr. H.H. Holmes. Okay, so he had three wives and numerous mistresses, and most of them ended up dead because he smooth-talked his way into them, into their lives, stole their money, and then killed them. And then he would steal cadavers in medical school and pretend the people had recently died, and he would collect the insurance money.
Oh my God.
Isn't this weird? Wow. And then there was also one time in this murder castle, he bought a really large safe on credit. Then he made a door frame smaller so it couldn't be removed from the room. And when the company came to collect it, he said they could take it, but he'd sue them if they damaged the building.
So he's an entrepreneur and a psychopath.
Exactly.
So cooking is my business, and business is good.
Let me say though, you know, you talk about how he like would charm his way into lives and stuff. Couldn't you see like if anybody could do it, couldn't Leonardo DiCaprio become that guy? You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like super charming, and if he went off the rails, we'd be in a lot of trouble.
Well, it's a little. It's kind of for this kind of bad guy. It's a little bit going to be a stretch for him, but I think he's totally.
I don't think it is a big stretch for him.
I don't think so either.
Yeah. Because you know what? Here's the thing, man. You know, like you always see him, you know, as a pretty boy, or even you know, Wolf of Wall Street, right? When you see Wolf of Wall Street, it's pretty out there. It's a true story, man, but he plays a really evil guy. He just does it with a handsome face, you know. But when you see The Departed, you see him, man. There's scenes where he's like, to me, it reminded me of Robin Williams. You only think of him as a funny guy, and you only think of him, you know, as humorous and fun-loving. But then you see him in a couple of the movies he's did.
Insomnia.
And he is like evil personified. And I can see DiCaprio coming out here doing this evil personified. There's a scene in the movie he does, Man Behind the Iron Mask, right? And there's a scene where he plays in there, and he's playing both parts, right? The twins.
Mm-hmm.
And he's telling his brother, the twin that was wearing the mask, he's going, his brother says, don't put me back on the mask. And he goes, he turns around and he's so evil, and he looks at me, did you wear that mask? And he goes, and you're going to wear it until you love it. You know, when he slams the mask down, you know. But the way he did it was just like, wow, I've never seen the side of him before.
Well, and remember Django Unchained, you know, but he was an unrepentant scumbag in that, and he sold it. You know,
it sounds like he'll be able to do this. He'll
you
be
had
able
my
to
interest, sir. Now you have my attention.
When I saw What's Eating Gilbert Grape with Johnny Depp, I was mystified on how they could get this poor kid to remember lines. I was like, how did he do that? You know, it must have been really a challenge to work with someone with challenges on the set, and then you find out,
wow. And it was DiCaprio.
As our dear friend Patrick Stewart would say, acting.
What's it in Gilbert Grape? I thought that the guy that was physically disabled, mentally challenged,
so did I.
Who played in the movie, because nobody knew who Leonardo DiCaprio was at the time.
Yeah, all he had done was a little bit of TV prior to that.
Right, and but, you know, he played that part, you know, to a T.
So well.
And, you know, but the thing is, you know, speaking of T's, Kayla's got the story about Trainwreck, and I can't wait to hear about it, man.
Yes, one that I would not want to board. But we have followed along Judd Apatow, and he has done movies like those raunchy bromances we've all seen, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, and recently he's shown his softer side with Funny People and This Is 40, though they were less successful. Now he has done the movie Trainwreck. This is his first movie that he has directed but did not write, because Trainwreck is the first screenplay from the film's star, Amy Schumer, who is a stand-up comedian, and you can see the poster for this movie. She's, you know, a blonde, cute girl, and she's just giving you the hold on one sec finger while she chugs down a shot. And
I'll be right with you.
Just hold a minute here. And this film for her is very personal. There's a lot of parallels in it for her. So Schumer grew up on Long Island and has a married sister named Kim and a father with multiple sclerosis. Stars in Trainwreck as a Long Island native named Amy, who has a married sister named Kim, played by Brie Larson, and a father with multiple sclerosis. So there's a lot of herself in this film. And you can see the trailer online. It starts out as her father making his young kids recite this mantra that monogamy is not possible because he just now is going through a divorce. Yeah, and so she has incorporated these words into her life, and she's like a young, confident woman, and she never spends the night with the men that she goes and has a good time with, nor does she let them spend the night at her place or continues dating them at all. She is also very successful and very happy. She works at a magazine called Snuff. It's your stereotypical dude bro party magazine. And she has been asked to write a story about a Manhattan sports doctor who treats the nation's top athletes. So the sports doctor, Aaron Connors, is actually played by Bill Hader. Oh. And so they have this nice, goofy SNL relationship that they bring to the movie, and they end up, you know, falling for each other as predicted. It's kind of a familiar rom-com dynamic, but there's this reversal of traditional on-screen gender roles where she's the player and he's like the one that wants her to settle with him. And they use real athletes in the movie. They have LeBron James in it, and it was funny. I was watching this thing where Judd Apatow was on Conan O'Brien, and they were saying, like, how was it difficult to direct these athletes and to show them how to actually act on screen? And they did a funny bit about it, but apparently it was actually easier than it seemed. So apparently the movie dragged on a little bit, but all in all, it had pretty good reviews, and it got a lot of people choked up, too.
You know what?
Sounds
I
really fun.
Saw yeah. the movie.
You
How
did.
Was it? Did it.
Okay.
Yeah, I saw the movie, man, and I'm here to tell you that movie is so fucking funny. It is so funny.
From the previews alone, made me laugh out loud.
Yeah. And so yeah. And that's just a teaser, man. Because like, you know, usually when you watch trailers in a movie, and that's a good point, Maya. You know, it's like they show you all the highlights, and it's like, why did I go see the movie?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But when you see the trailers from Trainwreck, you're thinking, man, they're funny. I mean, they are laugh out loud funny, right? Mm-hmm. But when you see the whole movie, it's like, man, we're just getting warmed up, you know. And the movie, nice. it does have, you know, a couple of the tear-jerking, you know, moments, you know, where it's a little sad because, you know, mm-hmm. her father's ill. But that's not, that doesn't, you know, dominate the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the scenes with LeBron James are just hysterical. And the scenes with LeBron James are not with Amy Schumer. They're with LeBron James and Bill Hader.
Uh-huh. Right.
Because he's the doctor.
Right.
Sports doc.
For LeBron James. And there's other big stars from the...
Matthew Broderick. And Colin Quinn as her dad, I heard, is amazing. And Dave Attell, even, the stand-up comedian. Well, I was going to say,
there's other big sports stars that are in there.
Oh.
Where Bill Hader treats them. You know? And... but there's a... you know, it's just hysterical because, like, you know, it's like, you know, you like Saturday Night Live a lot. But Bill Hader talking with LeBron James was so cool, man. Because it was like, LeBron James, he was a natural. He just played himself. And that's who he was. And, like, they're talking, and he's his doctor. And was, for all our listening audience out there, LeBron James traded teams. He not even played for Miami anymore. Now he plays back with the Cleveland Cavaliers. So he asked his doctor while they're sitting there, right? And they're going, he goes, how come you don't ever see me no more? And he goes, I see you. I'm seeing you right now. And he goes, yeah, but I'm at your office here, you know, in New York. And he goes, yeah. He goes, when I was in Miami, I used to come down here all the time. And he goes, yeah, but now you're in Cleveland. And he goes, well, and LeBron James with a real straight man face going like, Cleveland, Miami, what's the difference? He goes, nothing, man, nothing.
Nothing.
But the whole movie, Amy Schumer is so
Amy
funny.
Schumer is so funny. I actually saw her, I hate to admit it, but she was on The Bachelorette behind the scenes. She was coaching The Bachelorette, and I loved how raunchy she was. Like, because, you know, it's like, oh, roses and candles. And she was so crass and funny. I guess I'm sure
her
they edited it.
Show is hilarious.
And it made me realize that it would be really fascinating to see her play that role. So I look forward to seeing it too.
Yeah, I really want to see it too.
Oh, you know what? It is, I got to tell you, she is so funny. You know, go see the movie. You'll laugh. You'll walk out of the movie theater feeling really good.
Will it turn me into a monogamist though?
Monogamy is not possible.
Exactly. Mom. That's what I've always thought.
Monogamy. That's the opening scene.
That's the
The dad is sitting in the garage. The girls are sitting in the car. The little girl is trying to explain her divorce, and he's telling them, monogamy is not possible.
That's what
and
I
then
have
they start reading it on and on.
Unless you have a maple bacon condom.
Yeah.
Then I'm yours forever.
Time is Art with Holly Lorien Adams.
San Sequienza. That's the name of an amazing artist who lives in New York City. His works are bright and brilliant watercolors that pop off the page. It's amazing to find out with such precision that they're actually watercolors. He captures delicate energy of the subjects he's painting, and he features mostly celebrities, fashion divas, but yet also paints daily on the streets of New York City, from the homeless to the local legends, with the same love and respect as he gives to the famous people. He's, yes, indeed, been recognized by such as Madonna for his work on the rebel art from a rebel heart, as she called it on social media. He's also had several other celebrities and their families take note of his works. He says to the Huffington Post that paintings sometimes take 5 minutes, other times days. It just depends on everything going on in my head or around me. Like Picasso used to say, it took me all of my life to create this, or that, because in a way, the collector is receiving an extension of my life, my ups and downs, and experiences. So, 35 years is how long it takes for every piece. Indeed, living his masterpiece on the East Coast in New York City, San Sequienza, an iconic watercolor painter, worth discovering and exploring on your own. Check him out on social media. This is Holly Lorien Adams, and time is art.
And that's your art and entertainment news.
Keep listening for Downpour's special feature.
Don Thacker talks about his movie, Motivational Growth, starring Jeffrey Combs and a winner at 3 different film festivals. In this interview with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton. I love that guy.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me, Now Stay There. Today, we are very privileged to have on director Don Thacker, and he is from Detroit. He's going to tell us about his movie, Motivational Growth, and some of his other projects and movies that he's done. And it's such a pleasure to have you on. Welcome, Don.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hey, let's get right into it. Tell us about Motivational Growth.
Motivational Growth is a dark comedy fantasy movie about a gentleman who attempts suicide in his bathroom but fails. And he's not just headed up little bit, and when he wakes up, he finds himself face to face with a large chunk of fungus. And that chunk of fungus starts talking to him. And that is the titular motivational growth. That Rose is actually played by Jeffrey Combs, who's of Reanimator and Star Trek and all the cool, like, between 80s and now movies fame. He's a really cool actor. And Adrian DeGiovanni plays Ian, the main character. It's basically a two-man show with some side characters. And it is meant to be kind of a puzzle movie. So you watch it and you have to kind of figure out what happened and maybe talk to your friends about it and watch it a bunch more times and work it out. It's a fun little piece.
Well, where did you come up with the idea for motivational growth?
It's actually, the story of it is fairly interesting. I didn't actually have that idea. I had a completely different idea when I was pitching for budgets. And I had a $1 million movie I was pitching. And it was my first time as a director. So it was really hard to pitch this $1 million movie, especially since it was really weird and out there. So eventually I found that it was easier to pitch a much smaller movie. I was actually asked if I had anything smaller. And I said, yeah, of course I do, when I really didn't. So I had to come up with something smaller. So I went back to my idea book. Every kind of creator has this little idea book or, you know, some form of, you know, maybe it's online, maybe it's whatever, in their head entirely. But there's this thing where you could kind of just have ideas that maybe aren't fully fleshed out ideas. I have a bunch of those. And I think every creator kind of has a bunch of those. You think, one day I will implement these. So I went back to that book and effectively found the cheapest thing. So, like, a movie about a single guy, just one dude, one actor, got it. A movie about an antagonist, a really interesting antagonist that is basically stationary. That makes sense. And I got all these ideas and kind of put them together and said, is any of this viable? Can I make an actual film out of any of this? Or am I just screwed? Am I completely not able to produce this? So over the course of a couple of weeks, my producer and I worked out something that we could do that would be valuable for the money that we got. Doing something that would intrigue people and be a viable, saleable, wonderful feature film with the ideas that we had present. And luckily, there are so many ideas in that little book that we put together basis, just the bald sort of skeleton of motivational growth, a single guy dealing with a single antagonist in a single location, kind of dealing with people coming in and out. Now, there's a bunch of irony in that. The single antagonist was actually a highly complicated animatronic puppet thing, and that the single location was actually four different locations, four different sets that we had to build and, like, move around and do complicated stuff with. But still, it was still cheaper than doing some big epic, the film that I originally pitched, which was highly complex.
I've seen the movie. I really like, you know, the way you use, you know, the real actors and you mix it in with the animation. It's not an easy task to do.
I lucked out in that regard. With animation, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, so I had lots of films that I love watching that would every once in a while kind of, like, dip into an animated sequence, or the main character would travel into an animated sequence. Obviously, like, the low-hanging fruit there is something like Who Framed Roger Rabbit with, like, real actors and animated sequences and all that, and that was a really cool movie. But I remember things like one of my favorite movies ever is Better Off Dead, and there are two different types of animated sequence in that film. There's, like, the sort of claymated and, like, stop-motion animation that is used throughout that film, as well as hand-drawn animation. The main character, Lane, is actually an artist, and he draws little, like, sort of social scenarios that animate themselves, and he kind of travels into that world. So I always thought that was a really neat concept, a really neat way to convey sort of difference from reality. And I went digging for the right kind of look, and I found an artist named Jeremy Perrin in France who does amazing animation. He's kind of famous for a couple of his cool, they're very Parisian. you can look at, there's one called Trucker's Delight, which is a really, if you start there, you'll find Jeremy Perrin's name, and you can just kind of Google all over the place and get more of his stuff. It's really cool stuff. So I contacted him and said, you know, the only way this is going to work is if I get your work, because the stuff that our main character is traveling through is sort of a 16-bit animated video game, and this guy does amazing pixel art. So if I got you, we could make this work. If I didn't get you, we're not going to make it work. So the guy kind of signed on, and we went from there. But I used the animation to sort of convey our main character. He travels into a television a couple times, and his television has been sort of the main conveyance.
Yeah. You know what? As I said, I saw the movie, and I really liked that scene. You know, when he goes into the television. It's something I think that we've all thought we could do, especially as sports nuts, you know, at one point or another, you know.
There's this sort of idea where when you're watching enough, you kind of feel like you're in it. I mean, I think that's kind of, if you watch a movie and the movie's good enough, it'll suck you in kind of thing. So I really like the idea this guy lives so voraciously through his television. His television takes up the majority of his world. So that when things go wrong or when he needs a certain type of feeling, his television is where he actually goes. The movie takes place in 1991, which is why it has a chiptune soundtrack.
You know what?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, for our listening audience out there, where is the movie available?
As of yesterday, actually. The film came out on video on demand all over North America and the rest of the world. So you can get it on iTunes and Amazon and VHX and Netflix, DVD and Blu-ray. You'll also be able to find it on Redbox at some point. And there are some secret channels that we're kind of taking over, some distribution channels that have never really done movies before, but may be some of the largest distribution channels in the world that you'll find it on as well, as one of the first sort of opening films. So you can basically get it anywhere. Just look it up on the internet, Motivational Growth, and you'll find something. Don't click any of those like Russian, like download all of the free things, or wait till your friend buys it and go watch it at his house. I'm not actually super against sharing movies. I'm against piracy, obviously, or stealing or whatever. But I'm super not against, like, one person buying it and 90 people watching it off of that person.
That is, like, spoken like a true artist. So for all our listeners around the world, they'll be able to get it on Amazon. They'll be able to get it on Netflix. They'll be able to get it at Redbox. And it's, you know, something that we highly recommend. Now I want to move on to another subject here, because you did a movie. It's called The Catastrophe at Catalina.
Yes.
Now, I'm gonna give our audience a little bit about this. You know, it's about, you know, like when these four nuclear scientists create a nuclear laser in a remote nuclear testing facility on Catalina. And for our listeners out there around the world that don't know where Catalina is, it's an island about 27 miles off the coast of California. And the nuclear experiment tears a hole in the very fabric of time itself. And I'll let you... The very fabric of time itself. And I'll let you take it from there. All right, Don, take it away.
So that project was actually for a contest. My company, Imagos Films, had entered the contest to produce something for a Roger Corman festival that was going to be honoring Roger Corman. And the gag was to shoot something in the style of Roger Corman and, you know, that felt very Roger Corman. And early Roger Corman, like the old 50s sci-fi, 60s sci-fi stuff. So the competition required us to all kind of like be given a name, and we were given the Catastrophe at Catalina.
And, oh, I love it.
What we ended up doing was actually, I didn't want to do the competition because I didn't want to fake somebody else's style. I didn't want to be like, oh man, I'm going to watch a bunch of Roger Corman movies and kind of fake it. I'm a film dude, so I know a lot about Roger Corman and how he did stuff and how he would shoot stuff on sets, like when the sets weren't being used, and how he'd use wardrobe for other films, and how he'd use actors. He'd make actors stay after big productions. He'd have them stay a couple hours late every night for his little productions. Basically, using the found pieces to make a film kind of thing. So what we ended up doing was I was doing a stunt reel for a really popular stunt team. One by this guy named Aaron Crippen, who is amazing. He's currently doing stunts for Batman Superman. But he had a stunt team, a bunch of stunt dudes getting together, stunt dudes and ladies getting together, doing a bunch of stunt stuff, and they wanted to do this reel, this giant, like, all the cool things exploding reel. And I'd completely forgotten about the Catastrophe of Catalina until I realized I'm going to have a bunch of consummate actors, people who can get through some lines even, because they're stunt people. Some people are actually actors. I don't know if people know that, but some people actually have to do a lot of acting as well. So I'm going to have a bunch of stunt people. I'm going to have explosions. I'm going to have guns. I'm going to have knights in armor. I'm going to have all kinds of crazy stuff available to me. If I want to do something in the spirit of Roger Corman, why don't I do it for real? Why don't I shoot this reel? And while shooting the reel in our downtime and after take at late days or whatever, shoot a feature film that we write on the spot. That's kind of what we did. We shot this little thing. Basically, what's the premise? Well, what do we have? We have guns and knights. Cool. Nuclear scientists are trapped in a facility and they open up a time hole, which causes insanity to happen. So you'll have knights with guns and stuff. It's bonkers. And it's bonkers to be kind of that like it will blow your mind away kind of 1950s, 60s sort of like sci-fi thing. So we kind of did that. And we did that a bunch and came out with The Catastrophe of Catalina. And I was very proud to find that Roger Corman himself seemed to approve of it and posted it all over his Facebook page and talked about it a little bit too. So that was neat. It was a side project. It wasn't like a primary project of ours, but it was fun. And it seemed pretty great. It seems to go over really well. Anytime we show it at festivals or whatever. And it's not a moneymaker. It's not something you'd ever put anywhere.
But it's definitely something to sit down, have some popcorn, and watch a bunch of crazy stuff. Because we did tongue-in-cheeky. We did play it like we were playing a 50s thing. The other films in that sort of contest did this weird thing where they all tried to be like serious filmmakers, making a tribute to Roger Corman. And I didn't really, that's the thing I didn't want to do at all. I didn't want to like fake Roger Corman. But when I found myself in a position with a bunch of extra toys, you know,
right,
I could kind of throw something together with those toys. I remember the story of like the original Little Shop of Horrors, where Roger Corman basically had sets and effects and costumes and cast from three different movies just kind of sitting around. And he just threw them together and made this movie about this talking plant.
Huh. Well, hey, wherever you get your inspiration, you know, is all great. So, you know what, I want to thank you so much, Don, for coming on, and we hope to
Thanks
have
for
you.
Having me.
We hope you come back on and visit us again and tell us about your new movie.
Thank you very much. I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
To learn more about Don Thacker, visit us on our website at justimagineitinc.com. Hey!
These days, Ashland native and author Dr. Frank Romano spends most of his time in Paris, France, teaching and writing. He talks with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton, in this interview.
Welcome, everybody, to another exciting interview on Get Behind Me, Not Stay There. Today, we are really honored to have on back again Dr. Frank Romano, and we're speaking with him in France. Welcome, doctor. And, you know, it was such a blast. Last time we spoke with you, you were here in the United States, and that was a great interview. And you have a book, Love and Terror in the Middle East. Now you have your fourth edition is out, that is correct?
Yeah, something happened a few months ago when I was in the West Bank organizing another dialogue, because the third edition, I think, was the book we talked about,
right?
One of the editions anyway. Something happened. The third edition was what we talked about, but something between our interview and now. I was in the refugee camp there on the West Bank, and I had my dialogue that day, and it worked out fine. There were a lot of people showed, and we conversed, and I brought in some Israeli Jews. And then we met in the refugee camp later on. But that evening, a Palestinian was apprehended by the Israeli soldiers and then killed by them. And so the next day, the Palestinians were on a rampage. Really, they were in a riot, and I found myself in the middle of this riot. And what was really strange, Edward, was I was watching a riot, and people were telling me I should just leave because the crowd was getting out. There were several hundred, especially adolescents, but not only adolescents, walking, running, stampeding, so to speak, around the town square. And I just couldn't move. I'd never seen a riot before where they were burning tires and breaking windows and stuff. And all of a sudden, a group of about 50 of the adolescents started walking toward me. And I went, whoa, what is this? And then I started backing up, but I was in the back of a store that was locked, and the door was locked. There's nowhere I could go, and so I was kind of trapped. And so before I couldn't think very quickly. I kind of froze. The adolescents had surrounded me, and I felt, well, this is it. They're going to take out their anger on me because of the U.S. unbridled support of Israel. And they knew who I was, though, because I've been working in the refugee camp for years. But, you know, when a mob is crazed and hostile and volatile, I felt they're capable of doing anything and not even remember what they did the next day. But instead of, doing me any harm, all of a sudden, the leader of the group reached his hand out to shake my hand. And, you know, he had red eyes and almost frothing at the mouth and anger at what happened the night before, having one of them being killed, was able to calm down enough. And then they all kind of lined up to shake my hand and then joined the raging riot after it. And so I was so moved by this, Edward, and realizing, gee, if this crazed crowd could calm down just for a minute, kind of show a gesture of reasonableness or calmness, And I thought, you know, that this kind of fanned the wind of my work, thinking that maybe, fanned the sails of my work, Edward, thinking that maybe there's still hope. And so I wrote another chapter, and I talked to my publisher. I was almost about ready to write a whole new book about what happened, and the publisher said, no, just add a new chapter. And then a new chapter was added to Love and Terror in the Middle East, and a new cover, and it was re-edited. It was just published a few months ago, Love and Terror in the Middle East, fourth edition, adding this new chapter. It's called In the Midst of a Riot.
Yeah, I read it, and after hearing your description, it fascinates me, because it's like what you're describing is, what we normally, all of us see on that, we'll see it on TV or in a movie, or, and we can only imagine what it would be like, but to actually be there is, quite a whole different, ball game.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I've been going in and out of this refugee camp. Now, this is a very contested area in northern West Bank. It's one of the most contested parts of the Middle East.
Yeah,
Edward. And this is not much in the mainstream news. I think it's growing in the mainstream. The mainstream is required to report the truth now instead of filtering the news, because a lot of non-mainstream news sources are reporting the truth of what's going on, and people are getting wind of the truth, and they're asking mainstream news to stop filtering and telling them the truth. The radicalizing, first of all, of Iraq and Syria is directly proportional to the American foreign policy incompetence. And here's my example here.
Okay.
Among other reasons, a couple of years ago, when the Syrian crisis was really revving up, and people were up in arms over Bashar Assad, the president of Syria, and the massacres, and he was claiming that there were foreigners, a lot of them were lies, but then there were foreigners, and there were Islamists trying to take over the country. And then we heard, later about the chemical weapons. But there was a huge outcry. There was a call from within Syria by moderate Muslims, moderate Arabs, anti-Bashar Assad, that needed help. Now, the United States officially was against what officially came out, condemning Bashar Assad's massacres and what he was doing, trying to prevent these people from seeking any type of a democracy like in Tunisia, because it's all part of the Arab Spring movement, condemned by the U.S. But the U.S. turned its back on these moderate Syrians, and there were thousands of them. What choice did these modern Syrians have to fight against Bashar Assad after that? They were required to join up with one rebel group or the other, because they would be isolated. They had no arms. They had no sustenance. And those rebel groups that we've heard about, including ISIS, and a lot of them were funded by Al-Qaeda, were getting funds from the outside as well as from the inside. And so 2 years later, we have ISIS cropping up. And, of course, they've been around for a while, and they were connected with this group called Al-Nusra, which is also an Al-Qaeda group. We have to understand Al-Qaeda group. ISIS was originally connected with Al-Qaeda and helped form another Al-Qaeda-affiliated group in Syria. ISIS originated in Iraq, but was very much active in Syria, working with the rebels against Bashar Assad. And so this is what's happening here, Edward, to make a long story short. We failed to help the moderates. And then just a few weeks ago, because we don't have ground troops in Iraq anymore.
Right.
We withdrew them, right? And there's a great deal of pressure now for American help. And so we started the bombing. Remember, there was a time where the Yazidis, which are not Muslim, nor are they Jewish, nor Christian, a different religion, needed help and working with the Kurds. And they were surrounded and being massacred, as well as the Kurds. And our bombing did help them, help free them, and help some of the Kurds retake over their villages and to live and to avoid further massacre. But a lot of American jingoist generals are rattling the sabers again to send American soldiers back into the quagmire. And what is Obama calling for now? Obama calls for helping the moderate Syrian rebels. The fundamental problem is we had a prime opportunity to help them when they were still strong and still separate. Now, to find any moderate Syrian rebels against Bashar Assad, so that we can help them fight ISIS now. That's the deal. So Heisen, the ground troops on the ground, because in America it's still unpopular, to put it mildly, to send more American troops back, or send American troops back into the Iraqi quagmire. But they find that these moderate Syrians are no longer centralized. They literally have had to integrate into these rebel groups, which are mostly controlled by Islamist groups and mostly controlled by Al-Qaeda.
Right, but the, you know, the you know, we're going to wrap it up with this. You know, the thing is, you know, we want people to go out and get your Love and Terror in the Middle East, edition 4, the new chapter. Go to your websites, go to your book, you know, signings, and listen to your lectures. Listen to our program, you know, and other programs like that. I encourage that, you know, because not everyone's going to have the same opinion. But if we open up an honest dialogue where people are allowed to speak their minds and not have fear of retribution, you know, it's because that's where you're going to, you know, you start getting the healing. You know, you can't.
Yeah, the healing and the changing. We're going to make durable changes and do the right thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Through information, through the venues that you're supplying, Edward, and I really thank you again for allowing. We're going to work together. And I think you're right. At the end of the day, we will do the right thing, but we're struggling right now to get the true information out, and you're helping.
How's your brother doing?
Doing great. I mean, he's moved to Portland.
Uh-huh.
And he's going to graduate school there and working there, and he's got the children's book that just came out, and my New York publisher has published his book, and so he'll be on the circuit pretty soon and doing very well.
Cool. You know, we want to thank you again for coming on. We've been talking with Dr. Frank Romano, and he's been speaking to us from France. We're talking about Love and Terror in the Middle East, the fourth generation, new chapter 82, I believe it is. You need to get in there and read that. Books are available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, everywhere. And, of course, he'll be on our website. And I'll see you for Christmas when you come out here. It'll be great.
Yeah, I definitely will, Edward.
We'll see you at Christmas time.
Yes, definitely. Just people can contact me, frankfro@aol.com or www.frankromano-loveandterror4.com and my website. And I hope I get feedback from people. But thank you again.
Okay, you definitely will. And, of course, we'll have you on the Just Imagining site and up on PRX and on iTunes and all over the world. And let's get this message going.
To learn more about Dr. Frank Romano, visit his website at frankromano-lt.com.
Well, maybe we missed it, yeah. Thinking it could be different. It could. It should have been.
The Finest Hours, a soon-to-be-released major motion picture starring Chris Pine, Casey Affleck, Eric Bana, Holiday Grainger, and Ben Foster. In the winter of 1952, New England was battered by the most brutal nor'easter in years. As the weather wreaked havoc on land, the freezing Atlantic became a wind-whipped zone of peril, setting the stage for one of the most heroic rescue stories ever lived. On February 18th, while the storm raged, two oil tankers, the Pendleton and the Fort Mercer, were in the same horrifying predicament. Built with dirty steel and not prepared to withstand such ferocious seas, both tankers split in two, leaving the dozens of men on board utterly at the Atlantic's mercy. The Finest Hours is the gripping, true story of the valiant attempt to rescue the souls huddling inside the broken halves of the two ships. This spellbinding tale is overflowing with breathtaking scenes as boats capsize, bows and sterns crash into one another, and men hurl themselves into the raging sea in a terrifying battle for survival. Not all of the 84 men caught at sea in the midst of that brutal storm survived, but considering the odds, it's a miracle and a testament to their bravery that any at all came home to tell their tales.
18-year-old seaman Charles Bridges of Palm Beach, Florida, was asleep in his bunk before the ship lurched and cracked, but the terrible sound made him bolt to his feet. "I grabbed my pants, shoes, and a life vest and ran topside," recalls Bridges. "I went into the mess deck where some of the other men had gathered. The power was out, and it was still dark outside, so it was hard to know what was going on. Before anyone could stop me, I grabbed a flashlight and ran up to the catwalk to see what the men on the bow of the ship were doing. I shined the flashlight on the steel floor of the catwalk and quickly followed it amidships. The waves were enormous, and their spray was whipping across the deck, mingling with the cold sleet falling. Then I stopped in my tracks, because the catwalk floor disappeared, and I realized just two more steps, and I'd drop straight down into the ocean. Bridges wheeled around and scurried back to the mess deck, shouting, "We're in trouble! The ship has broken too!" Some of the men talked of immediately lowering the lifeboats, but Bridges told them they were crazy, that the lifeboats wouldn't stand a chance in the enormous waves. Down in the lowest deck of the ship, where the fire room was located, no one knew what had happened, but Fireman Frank Foteau of Attleboro, Massachusetts, feared the worst. Foteau, a 9-year veteran of the sea, was a large man with thick whiskers that ran across his square jawline, giving him the look of a modern-day Captain Ahab. He had survived the torpedoing of his destroyer in the Mediterranean during World War II, as well as the explosion of the SS Grand Camp in 1947, which triggered a 15-foot tidal wave that killed hundreds in Texas City, Texas. Foteau felt the Pendleton lurch and heard the loud explosion that followed. He fought to brace himself as a more violent lurch rattled the wounded ship. Foteau immediately thought of the disasters he had escaped in the past and believed his luck had finally run out. Moments later, Chief Engineer Siebert came running into the fire room. "The ship is split in half," he hollered.
Nearly 57 years later, it's a breathtaking story that still defies the imagination, says the Cape Cod Chronicle. Michael J. Togias is the author of more than 10 books, including Overboard, The Finest Hours with Casey Sherman, Fatal Forecast, and 10 Hours Until Dawn, the true story of heroism and tragedy aboard the Can-Do. He is a sought-after lecturer who gives more than 70 presentations each year. He lives in Massachusetts. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to downpour.com.
Me Now Stay There is a Just Imagine It Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call us at 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineitinc.com. I'm Maya Seligman.
I'm Holly Lorian Adams.
I'm Jerry Renfro.
I'm Kayla Elrod.
I'm Sean Mark Nipper.
And I'm Charlie Stanton, and we like you, so be sure to like us on Facebook. And remember to get behind me.
Now stay there.